Referring to failures of the U.S. in Afghanistan, Omar said, "War and conflict never produce peace and stability. Violence and militarism, even when cloaked in the language of humanitarianism, are fundamentally at odds with human flourishing and opportunity. Violence only produces trauma that can turn into anger, vengefulness, and a continuing cycle of violence. That must be a lesson as we deal with conflicts around the world."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station, and I'm glad you guys are with us here on Arab English Radio. I am Zainab, your humble host for the show.
And I am Brother Yasir, co-host on the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, bro. You grew up in a Muslim majority country, or no?
No.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in South Africa.
Oh, wow.
And then I went to the UK.
No. Have you ever met Nelson Mandela in person?
No, but I know people who have.
Cool. Oh, now I know people who know people who know Mandela.
I mean, my grand uncle is very close to him.
Okay. Seriously?
Yeah.
My life is complete.
My late grandmother actually sat on his lap. There is a picture of it somewhere, but I never found it.
No. I'm not going to do Youth Station anymore. I'm just going to go home and collect royalties.
Royalties, no.
Oh, man, that was so cool. MashaAllah. Okay, may Allah bless all their souls. So you didn't grow up in a Muslim majority country. Was it hard?
In South Africa, no, because...
So diverse, right?
Not diverse, because when apartheid came, a section of people, right? And so where we stayed was in majority Indian population. So within there were Muslims.
You're among your own people.
Basically, right? So you're Muslims, Hindu, or Christian who are of Indian origin. That whole section was just Indian or Indian origin. So it wasn't like you were out of place. You were basically in small India.
Interesting.
So everything was there. Like, there were masajis everywhere. There were Hindu temples. There were churches. So everybody had their own thing. Everybody lived in harmony, so to speak.
It
coexisted,
right.
So to speak. And then I went to the UK.
Oh, no.
And this was different now.
And then stuff went sideways.
Yeah, because then, obviously, it is not segregated. Whether segregation was good or bad, that's another issue. But it was not. It was like one whole big melting pot of everything. And the masajids were far. There was no adhan. So there was a bit of a...
You could barely find food.
So adapting was a bit of a trick or tricky. And alhamdulillah, we did it. But... yeah, I mean, myself, personally, as the question of the show was mentioned, I'm very strong-minded. I'm sure you know.
Yes, I've noticed.
So I don't really get...
he really doesn't give a rat's tush.
Yeah, I don't.
No, he really doesn't. He doesn't give a rat's whiskers about almost anything. And he's just unbothered, totally chill, comfortable with himself.
Yeah.
And I aspire to be that. This chill, this...
Like, even...
When you moved to the UK, what posed more problems for you? The racism toward your race or the racism toward your religion?
I didn't myself personally...
Because in some areas, religion is like racism.
It wasn't, because alhamdulillah, where we were, it was also over a period of time... Majority of Muslims or people who of color moved into that particular area.
Mm-mm.
There wasn't that much racism that I came across personally. I did not come across that much racism, which was a good thing, alhamdulillah. The school that I went to also was, I think I was the only Muslim in that school. But even then, like, I held my own. I wasn't taken aback by anything. I did my own thing. I would pray my salah and no one said anything to me.
Mm.
Even university, I would do the same. Mm. But as like I mentioned, I'm...
What's your secret?
Like, I didn't get fuffled by anything. You know?
How?
People ask... I'll give you one example.
Oh, I love examples.
And it's actually something that... And it actually showed the difference between two Muslims. Right? There were three of us, okay. Close friends.
Right.
So these are school friends from back in the day. I'm still in contact with them. Right? They're not very religious, but they're friends, right? We would go out, and obviously to the limit that I would do. If they did other things, that I would not go. I would prevent myself from going, even from those days.
You drew a line.
So one day we were going somewhere, and one of the three, one who was the least of the three, he actually previously had gone to Dubai for a holiday, to Dubai. And he would, I'll put it in a nice way, brag about his night escapades.
Uh-huh.
He would brag about it.
Right.
So the other friend of mine next to me, he got a bit shy and stuff. I could see it, right?
Like uncomfortable.
He
was
uncomfortable because he didn't know, like, should I, like, be with him? Should I encourage him or not? So I said to him, like, look, I'm still happy that I've not done anything like that. Mm. I'm proud. I told him, I'm proud I've not done that thing that you said. I've not done it. Mm. Like, I'm still, you know, and I'm still, like, I'm still pure, right? The other friend then took my words and said, yes, I'm also proud.
That's really important.
You see, because
when it comes to youth, the moment they feel like...
This peer pressure is important.
Exactly. The moment they feel like they're not alone, they have a clique, they have a people, they're less prone to being humiliated, less prone to being feeling that they're being brought down. You're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break. Don't go anywhere.
Allah, Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab, and my co-host is Brother Yasser. As a Muslim youth, I get humiliated when I fill in the blanks. Brother Yasser has never been humiliated in his life ever, at all. Bro, do you even know how to spell the word? Like, look, how?
I'm not humiliated by others, but I feel humiliated by my own actions.
Oh, you humiliate yourself. Nice.
Yeah. That's different.
Nice.
I feel that's what happens a lot. Other people, I don't care what you say.
Okay.
That, I'm sure I've said that before.
That's a really good, that's a really strong level of, you know, of awareness. That's like you being woke. Mm. Like, y'all can't humiliate me. I'm busy humiliating myself.
Yeah, I'll do my own thing, you know. You know, like, some people, for example, Muslims in, like, these countries, one of the things that they may feel humiliated by is the way they speak, the accent they have.
Mm.
In some countries, you know, they have this superiority complex regarding the way they speak English.
Yeah.
So when you tell them that a particular Eastern countries, for example, India or even Pakistan, for example, speak better English than they do, they can, like, but their accent is, I said, doesn't matter.
Mm.
What does the accent have to do with the way that they speak?
Exactly.
The way that they... are able to make you understand what they want to say.
Mm. Which is the objective.
Which is
of
the objective.
Language.
Exactly. And for sort of have an accent.
Mm. See, I think you have been able to become so undoted. I'm not just say unbothered. It's because you having a situation, taking a step back, looking at it objectively, analyzing it, and, you know, trying to understand that, does it matter what other people think about me in this situation? Is it going to in any way, shape, or form hinder my journey toward my objective. If it's not, then let them think whatever they want, right? And that's so important for youth to be able to develop within themselves. I think often about the youth of the event of Ashura, right? Because as someone who is still in her 20s, they are basically the only age group that I can remotely relate to, right? If I could think about Sayyidah Zainab Salamullah Alayha as well, but it's still going to take me a good 30-something years of training to get in her atmosphere. Imam al-Hussein Alayhi Salam, he trained the youth in his company so well that on the eve of Ashura, when he was giving his lecture, his son asked him that, Dad, but are we not in the right? And Imam al-Hussein said, yeah. And then his son said, all right, cool.
Yes, ma'am.
Come what may. If I'm doing the right thing, I don't care if they shred me apart with their swords and daggers. I am going to do what I think is right and what's right by my Lord. Right? And that is such a beautiful lesson that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam taught us, that be sure of what you're doing. As a Muslim youth, if we are sure of what we're doing, and that can only be possible when we actively try to obtain sufficient knowledge about our religion, when it results into our confidence in what we're doing, then yeah, we'll all be Brother Yasir. We won't get humiliated by anyone. We won't feel embarrassed about our practices, about our religious accomplishments or lack of accomplishment in other peculiar fields, you know? And that is, yeah, it's easier said than done.
It is. It's definitely easier said than done.
Mm.
It takes a lot of self-reflection.
Yeah.
A lot of understanding of what really matters, what doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that even if a person is not easily humiliated, that there isn't an internal conflict. That is internal conflict in this person. You know, he goes about it in a way that, you know, he may seem that it's not affecting him or her. But he's able, or she's able to then this, you know, to win that internal conflict, so to speak. There's always an internal conflict. It will always be that. For example, this person said something. Sometimes it's easy just to bat away. Other times it's not.
Yeah.
Or you see something by... If let us change the question, right? Instead of just doing that ourselves, like what do... As a Muslim youth, what would the acts of other Muslims do that humiliate us? That's a different issue. You know, for example, we see certain... From my own upbringing, like I would see... friends of mine who are Muslims doing all sorts of crazy things.
Yeah,
I'm sure you are the same.
Exactly. You're ruining the Muslim name, and then
when you say, I don't do it, then people look, but
he
does
it. Yeah.
She does it. He does
it. That Muslim does it. Why aren't you
joining?
Exactly. And then you just end up facepalming yourself.
Yeah.
No, that's not how it works.
I mean, that's difficult. But again, if a person is able to kind of get to a level like, okay, whatever. They do what they want.
That's very important to reach that level. They do what they want. Be confident about what you're doing because you're sure that it's the right thing to do, because you've researched about it enough and you've collected enough knowledge, information, and data to back up whatever it is that you're doing. And perhaps you won't be able to do it all on your own. You need a support group. You need someone to fall back on, someone to rely on, someone to turn to when you've got questions. And you're still young. I mean, we're still young to say that, oh, it takes a great degree of self-refinement. It is true, but we haven't had that enough time to do that
it'll
yet.
It'll come with experience.
Yeah. So I would say read a lot. Yeah, it's really, you can do no wrong with reading a lot. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen too, right? That he who finds company in books has not basically lost anything. Because once you have your nose in a book, you wouldn't have time to be humiliated. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you made. the one I call creator, my alpha and omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Former President Donald Trump has claimed that the United States is being set up by the Taliban just days after the Taliban took control of Kabul and effectively gained control of Afghanistan. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist James Crump, writing for the Newsweek magazine. The piece is titled Donald Trump Tells Hannity America Being Set Up by Taliban. Former President Donald Trump has claimed that the United States is being set up by the Taliban just days after the Taliban took control of Kabul and effectively gained control of Afghanistan. Trump made the comments during a Tuesday night, 17th of August, interview with Fox News Channel host Sean Hannity, where he was asked about the ongoing situation in Afghanistan that has seen hundreds of Afghans trying to flee the country by climbing onto military planes after the Taliban took control of Kabul. Sean Hannity asked Donald Trump about his dealings with Taliban leaders and the Afghan government, as he had prepared to withdraw U.S. military troops from the region during his time in charge. The troops were officially ordered out of the area by President Joe Biden in April, and the Taliban took control of the country just a few weeks before they were scheduled to leave on 11th of September. Donald Trump claimed that the United States is being set up by the Taliban, telling Sean Hannity, "I never saw anything so stupid in my life until the last few days with Afghanistan. That blows the stupidity of the southern border away." He added, "What's happening in Afghanistan is unbelievable, and we are being set up by the very tough people that are very great negotiators. I'll tell you what, they're automatically great negotiators who have been fighting for 1,000 years, and everything about them, they negotiate. We are being set up, and in a certain way, I guarantee you, they consider them to be hostages, and let's see what happens over the coming weeks." Donald Trump also claimed there could be as many as 40,000 potential hostages left behind in Afghanistan. Trump, who had promised to bring U.S. troops home from Afghanistan, reached an agreement with the Taliban when he was in office that set a 1st of May 2021 deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. forces with conditions. The former president said he told the top Taliban leader that if any Americans were harmed, we will hit you with a force that no country has ever been hit with before. Despite Donald Trump's claims that the Taliban had been fighting for thousands of years, in actual fact, the Taliban was only founded back in 1994, holding power in a majority of Afghanistan between 1996 and 2001, before U.S. forces invaded the country. Later in the interview with Sean Hannity of Fox News Channel on Tuesday, 17th of August, Donald Trump claimed that he had a conditions-based agreement with the Taliban after they agreed a ceasefire with him, where if any Americans or allies were harmed, then the U.S. would retaliate by bombing parts of the country. He said that Joe Biden should have got all of the U.S. civilians out of Afghanistan first, before saying the president's actions have caused the greatest embarrassment in the history of our country, and adding, "It's a great thing that we're getting out of Afghanistan, but nobody has ever handled the withdrawal worse than Joe Biden." President Biden made his first remarks in Afghanistan for a week at the White House on Monday, 16th of August, where he dismissed criticisms of his decision to withdraw U.S. forces from the region, saying, "If anything, the development of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision." Joe Biden also noted that he inherited a deal from Donald Trump to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, before once again backing the decision, saying, "American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves." Former President Donald Trump also criticized his successor's handling of the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, saying he would have gotten Americans and equipment out of the country before military personnel, and that he had an agreement with the Taliban he was willing to back up with force.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson, the Kufan mentality. It is very surprising that 12 or 17,000 persons had taken the oath of allegiance to Muslim. But when he came to know about what had happened to Hani and called his supporters to rise, not more than 4,000 persons turned up. So where did the rest go? They just didn't want to be part of the fight. They did not want to make a stand against falsehood and injustice. And still more surprising is that at the time when Muslim came out with 4,000 armed men and Ibn Ziyad closed the doors of his palace, not more than 50 persons were with him. And out of them, 30 were policemen and remaining 20 were some dignitaries and the members of his family. So see how, step by step, Muslim, the representative of the infallible Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, is losing support. He had gained that support initially when everybody saw that they are going to be successful and victorious, but as soon as the enemies, they pressed onto the gas pedal, people started to disappear. The people had encircled his place and were abusing him and his father. This apparently favorable state of affairs became so unfavorable in the early part of the night that Muslim bin Aqil offered evening prayers in the night of 9th Zilhajj in the Masjid of Kufa with only 30 persons. And when he left the Masjid, only 10 persons were with him. And when he came out of the Masjid, according to this historical account, there was not even one person who might accompany him. Allah knows those who are truthful and knows those who are liars. Chapter 29, verse 3.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Before the break, we were discussing the Kufan mentality, and you see how these Kufans, they disappeared from around the representative of Imam Hussein alayhi salam after writing all those letters and pledging the oath of allegiance. It is sufficient proof of the falsity of the claims, correspondence, and pretenses of the Kufans that 4,000 armed men could not subdue Ibn Ziyad, who had not more than 50 persons with him, and gained control over the city. And the only one false rumor spread by the supporters of Ibn Ziyad was that the Syrian army was arriving. It scattered them all. Brothers and sisters, the first lesson we want to draw from this historical narrative is that the weak oaths of allegiance get exposed when the uprising takes place, when the challenges are applied and the difficulties are applied. The weak oaths of allegiance, they are not fruitful. Lesson number two, fear, insecurity, lack of trust in Allah result in abandonment of Haqq. If you notice, in the Kufan mentality, fear, insecurity, and lack of trust in Allah's promises and Allah Himself, it caused them to abandon Muslim bin Aqil and make Imam Hussein alayhi salam weak. Lesson number three is false and hollow threats of the enemy. If you notice, towards the end of this historical account, we mentioned to you that Ibn Ziyad had spread a rumor, only a rumor, it had no reality, that there was an army from Syria that is arriving to support Ibn Ziyad and Yazid. It was a rumor, there was no army coming. But these so-called supporters of Imam Hussein, these so-called supporters of Muslim bin Aqil, they chickened out. They fled here and there just based on this hollow threat. So if you look at today, the Zionists, America, Britain, Germany, France, they all get together against the righteous servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Islam at a macro level. What happens is they give these hollow threats. These threats that are not going to materialize. And sometimes we see that the believers, they repeat the history. They flee from the battlefield. But alhamdulillah today, the camp of the truth and justice and Haqq, it is stronger than ever before. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence fill the air.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of Afghans employed by G4S to guard the British embassy until last year feared they would be killed by the Taliban after being abandoned by the British, while their successors who were promised help last week have since only received redundancy notices. Ahmad, not his real name, a former close protection officer and interpreter at the British embassy in Kabul, made a desperate plea to Britain's Prime Minister. If I could get a message to Boris Johnson, I would shout at him for help. If he doesn't help us, we will be killed, he said by phone from Kabul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Matthew Weaver and Amelia Gentleman. The piece is titled, Afghans Who Guarded British Embassy Fear Being Killed by the Taliban. Hundreds of Afghans employed by G4S to guard the British embassy in Kabul until last year feared they will be killed by the Taliban after being abandoned by the British, while their successors who were promised help last week have since only received redundancy notices. Ahmad, not his real name, a former close protection officer and interpreter at the British embassy in Kabul, made a desperate plea to Britain's Prime Minister. If I could get a message to Boris Johnson, I would shout at him for help. If he doesn't help us, we will be killed, he said by phone from Kabul. Ahmad is now in hiding with his family, one of an estimated 300 G4S employees now doing the same, and is convinced they will be killed by the Taliban if they are found because of their work with the British. The group applied for assistance and asylum under the UK government's Afghan Relocation and Assistance Policy, or ARAP. But they said they were rejected because they were not hired directly by the British government. He said, last Tuesday, the Taliban came to my father's house looking for me and my documents. I cannot eat, I cannot sleep, I can't talk to people because I'm scared. My family is in a very bad situation. My wife is crying, and we feel that we've been abandoned. Ahmad worked at the British Embassy in Kabul before G4S lost the contract in June of 2020 to the global security company Garda World. By way of proof, he shared a photograph of himself on a British Embassy delegation to Camp Arena in Herat on 15th of November 2018. Last week, the government said all 125 Garda World security staff will be granted the right to enter the United Kingdom after their plight was highlighted by the Observer. But the staff have had no news or advice about how to leave Kabul since then. The only communication they received on Sunday, 22nd of August, was a formal termination letter from Garda World telling them their services were no longer required. Written in Dari, the letter for dissemination to all staff working on the British Embassy contract stated, Dear Garda World colleagues, because Afghanistan is facing an uncertain future, recent events across the country mean that Garda World doesn't have any choice but to suspend operations in Afghanistan immediately and indefinitely. The Guard's local supervisor said everyone had felt upset and hopeless when they read the letter, which was sent by the Dubai-based regional director for Afghanistan. We know of lots of people working for the United Kingdom, United States, Canadian-funded projects. None of them did this or their personnel. Instead of helping us to get out of this situation while our lives are at greater risk, they are sending this termination letter to us, the Guard's supervisor said. The letter stated that any further payments would depend on negotiations between the Foreign Office and Guard of World. The letter also stated that negotiations were continuing over how to get staff to the airport in Kabul. The company's management was confident that UK visas will be granted to the guards, but the logistics of getting them into the airport in Kabul remains challenging. The company's remaining British staff were taken from the company compound to Kabul Airport last Friday during an evacuation operation for all Guard of World expatriate staff. None of the Afghan guards were included, according to the supervisor. Most of the security guards working at the British Embassy in Kabul have now fled their homes because they no longer feel safe, he added. We've packed small bags and we're waiting for news. We've asked to be transported to the airport. We hope they will do that, but we're running out of time. Everyone is afraid. The prospects are even bleaker for the ex-G4S staff, most of whom were employed by the company until last week when the Taliban entered Kabul. Mohammed, a 41-year-old who was a senior watchkeeper at the World Bank in Kabul until last week and had also worked as a security guard at the British Embassy in Kabul, said the group was desperate. He has asked G4S and the British government for help on behalf of the group. G4S said we should apply for asylum. They have done nothing for us, but they should help us. He added, we have asked the British government many times about the asylum issue, but all the emails have been rejected. Mohammed has three sons and four daughters, aged between 1 and 13. He said, we are hiding at home. We cannot go outside. The Taliban are searching house by house in the capital, Kabul, now trying to find anyone who worked with foreign people. Absolutely, they will kill me if they find me. He said, if he had an email from the British government, he could get access to the airport and a chance to fly to safety.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Why didn't he refuse to fight with several thousand fighter army of Yazid, in spite of having only 72 people in his army? Why didn't he try other methods? December 13th, 2009. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones to the desert of Karbala in order to clarify the truth. He knew what was going to happen, yet he brought Zainab, his wives, his children, and his brothers with him. Like the day of Mubahila, it was again a matter of clarifying the truth and promoting Islam in the real sense of the word. That shows the importance of promoting Islam. If someone comes across a ruthless sultan who mixes up halal with haram and breaks his promise to God, they deserve living with the sultan in the hereafter. That is to say, when someone sees such a person, they should clarify the truth through their words and actions, just as Imam Hussein did, and he paid the price for it. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones and his wives and children to Karbala in order to clarify the truth.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
One can clearly notice in his lifestyle all the methods that could have been used by a descendant of the Holy Prophet to preserve the great legacy of Islam, which has been passed down by the Holy Prophet and his father as well as the genuine followers. We can clearly see everything in the lifestyle of the Lord of the Martyrs, everything ranging from clarification to forewarning to promotion of Islam to provoking the conscience of prominent figures of his time during a sermon in Mina. All these things are tangible in the lifestyle of the Lord of the Martyrs. Later on, he stood up against a great deviation and laid down his life. Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible imam. Infallible imams' extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads.
You've done
in the limelight.
Western politicians and media colluded in duping their publics into believing Afghanistan was a winnable war, says Jonathan Cook, writer, in an article published under the heading How Taliban Surge Exposed Pentagon's Lies. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The speed with which the Taliban have re-established their hold on a country that was supposedly being reconstructed as some kind of Western-style liberal democracy is astonishing, or at least it is to those who believe that U.S. and British military commanders, Western politicians, and the mainstream media were being straight all this time. The real explanation for the Taliban's surprise success is that Western publics were being duped all along. The United States' longest war was doomed from the start. The corrupt, entirely unrepresentative members of the Kabul elite were always going to jump ship as soon as Washington stopped pumping in troops and treasure. According to Forbes magazine, as much as $2 trillion were poured into Afghanistan over the past 20 years, or $300 million a day. The truth is that Western politicians and the media intentionally colluded in a fiction, selling yet another imperial war in a far-off land as a humanitarian intervention welcomed by the local population. As Daniel Davis, a former U.S. Army lieutenant colonel and critic of the war, observed at the weekend, since early 2002, the war in Afghanistan never had a chance of succeeding. Nonetheless, many politicians and commentators are still sounding the same tired tune, castigating the Biden administration for betraying Afghanistan, as if the U.S. had any right to be there in the first place, or as if more years of U.S. meddling could turn things around. The motive for U.S. officials and corporations to conspire in the ground deception is clear. But what about the mainstream media? The self-declared fourth state and the public supposed watchdog on abuses of state power. Why were they missing in action all this time? It is not as though they did not have the information needed to expose the Pentagon's lies in Afghanistan, had they cared to. The clues were there and even reported occasionally, but the media failed to sustain attention. As far back as 2009, as the U.S. was preparing a pointless surge of troops to tackle the Taliban, Carl Elkenberry, then ambassador to Afghanistan, sent a cable to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that was leaked to the New York Times. He wrote that additional U.S. forces would only delay the day when Afghans will take over. A decade later, the Washington highlighted the Pentagon's systematic deceptions and lying. The subtitle was At War with the Truth. Bob Crowley, an Army colonel who had advised U.S. military commanders in Afghanistan, observed, "Every data point was altered to present the best picture possible." The Post concluded that the U.S. government had made every effort to deliberately mislead the public. John Sopko, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction appointed by Congress in 2012, had long detailed the waste and corruption in Afghanistan and the dismal state of the Afghan forces. But these reports were ignored or quickly disappeared without trace, leaving the Pentagon free to peddle yet more lies and lies and lies. In the summer, as he issued yet another report, Sopko made scathing comments about claims that lessons would be learned. Don't believe what you're told by the generals or the ambassadors or people in the administration saying, we are never going to do this again. That's exactly what we said after Vietnam. Lo and behold, we did Iraq and we did Afghanistan. We will do this again. A good part of the reason the Pentagon can keep recycling its lies is because neither Congress or the media is holding it to account. The US media have performed no better. In fact, they have had their own incentives to cheerlead rather than scrutinize recent wars. Not least, they benefit from the drama of war as more viewers tune in, allowing them to hike their advertising rates. The handful of companies that run the biggest TV channels, newspapers, and websites in the US are also part of a network of transnational corporations whose relentless economic growth has been sped on by the so-called war on terror and the channeling of trillions of dollars from the public purse into corporate hands. The cozy ties between the U.S. media and the military are evident too in the endless parade of former Pentagon officials and retired generals who sit in TV studios commenting as independent experts and analysts on U.S. wars. Their failures in Iraq, Libya, and Syria have not apparently dented their credibility. That rotten system was proudly on display again as the media uncritically shared the assessment of David Petraeus, the former U.S. commander in Afghanistan. Although Petraeus shares an outsized chunk of responsibility for the past two decades of military failure and Pentagon deception, he called for the might of the U.S. military to be restored for a final push against the Taliban. Were it still possible to hold U.S. officials to account, the Taliban surge over the past few days would have silenced Petraeus and brought Washington's huge war scam crashing down. Instead, the war industries will not even need to take a pause and regroup. They will carry on regardless, growing and prospering as though their defeat at the hands of Taliban signifies nothing at all.
Around the world with reporters.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. The Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, they warned, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban vote comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by the members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported, amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020. Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Saturday, Iran's parliament began its open session differently, hosting some of the ministers-to-be and the president himself to attend the vote of confidence session. The process began after week-long behind-closed-doors deliberations on Raisi's proposed list of ministers. Based on the parliament regulations, the president is given 2.5 hours' time to introduce and defend his nominees before five pros and five cons from